We may look upon the ego as a manifestation of the monad on the higher mental plane, but we, page 297, must understand that he is infinitely far from being a perfect manifestation. Each descent from plane to plane means much more than a mere veiling of the spirit, it means also an actual diminution in the amount of spirit expressed. Although to speak of spirit in terms of quantity is inaccurate and misleading, yet, if an attempt is to be made to express these higher matters in human words at all, such incongruities cannot be wholly avoided. The nearest that we can come, in the physical brain, to a conception of what happens to the monad, when he involves himself in matter, is to say that only part of him can be shown, and even that part must be shown in three separate aspects, instead of in the glorious totality which he really is in his own world. So, when the second aspect of the triple spirit comes down a stage, and manifests as buddhi or intuition, it is not the whole of that aspect which so manifests, but only a fraction of it. So again when the third aspect descends two planes, and manifests as intellect, it is only a fraction of what the intellect aspect of the monad really is. Therefore the ego is not a veiled manifestation of the monad, but a veiled representation of a minute fraction of the monad. Following the ancient maxim, as above, so below, as the ego is to the monad, so is the personality to the ego. By the time we have reached the personality, the fractionization has been carried so far that the part we are able to see bears no appreciable proportion to the reality of which, nevertheless, it is the only possible representation, to us. Yet with and from this hopelessly inadequate fragment, we strive to comprehend the whole. Our difficulty in trying to understand the monad is the same in kind, but much greater in degree, as that which we found when we tried really to grasp the idea of the ego. Diagram 39 is an attempt, however inadequate, to represent graphically the relationship between the monad, the ego and the personality. The monad has been compared with a flame, page 298, the ego or triple spirit with the fire, and the personality with the fuel. The correspondence between the monad in its relation to the ego, and the ego in its relation to personality, will bear a little further amplification. As the ego is triple, so is the monad. The three, page 197, constituents of the monad exist on the first three planes of our system, viz., the adi, the anupadaka and tma planes. On the atmic plane the monad takes to itself a manifestation, which we call the monad in its atmic vesture, or sometimes the triple tma, or triple spirit. This is for the monad what the causal body is for the ego. Just as the ego takes on three lower bodies, mental, astral, and physical, the first of which, the mental, is on the lower part of his own plane, and the lowest, the physical, two planes below, so the monad regarding him now as the triple tma spirit takes on three lower manifestations, tma, buddhi manas, the first of which is on the lower part of his own plane, and the lowest two planes below that. It will thus be seen that the causal body is to the monad what the physical body is to the ego. If we think of the ego as the soul of the physical body, we may consider the monad as the soul of the ego in turn. For, just as the causal body takes, from the personality, whatever is of a nature to help its growth, page 299, so the causal body, through its inner or upper side, passes on, into the third aspect of tma, the essence of all experiences which may have entered into it. What is thus poured into the nasic aspect of tma renders it capable of acting without the causal body, that is, without a permanent vehicle which limits it. This throws light on the phenomenon of the perishing of the causal body, or individuality, with which we have already dealt in chapter 31. Diagram XL is an attempt to illustrate these somewhat complex correspondences and relationships. The entire higher triad, Atma Buddhi Manas, may also be regarded as the buddhi of the still more inclusive triad of monad, ego and personality. That larger buddhi is triple, Willkomma wisdom and Aktivatya, and its third aspect, Kriya Shakti, in due course comes into operation in the body, to awaken its organs and liberate its latent powers. The statement, in light on the path, that the warrior in man is eternal and sure, may be taken as relatively true of the ego in relation to the lower self and absolutely true with regard to the monad in relation to the ego. The ego, as we have seen, may make mistakes at an earlier stage, but is far less likely to do so than is the personality. The monad, on the other hand, makes no mistakes, although his knowledge of conditions down here may be somewhat vague. But his instinct must be on the side of right, for he is divine. Neither the ego nor the monad have as yet accurate knowledge, because their evolution is not complete. They are for us as guides, and one cannot, page 300, do other than follow them. But even as guides they are themselves unfolding. Page 198. We may note here that the triple manifestations of the monad is that which Christianity speaks of as the three persons in one God, teaching, in the Athanasian Creed, that men should worship one God in Trinity and Trinity in unity, neither confounding the persons nor dividing the substance, that is to say, never confusing the work and function of the three separate manifestations, each on its own plane, yet never for a moment forgetting the eternal unity of the substance that which lives behind all alike, on the highest plane, where these three are one. Such considerations are not merely of theoretical value, but have also some practical bearing on life. Although we cannot grasp the full meaning of such teaching, yet we should at least know that there are these three lines of force, and yet that all the force is one and the same. Without knowing that, we cannot grasp the method by which our world came into existence, nor can we understand man, whom God made in his own image, and who therefore is also three and yet one, Atma Buddhi Manas, and yet one spirit. We may regard the three parts of the higher self as three aspects of a great consciousness or mind. They are all three modes of cognition. Atma is not the self, but is this consciousness knowing the self. Buddhi is this consciousness, knowing the life in the forms, by its own direct perception. Manas is the same consciousness looking out upon the world of objects. Karma Manas is a portion of the last, immersed in that world, and affected by it. The true self is the monad, whose life is something greater than consciousness, which is the life of this complete mind, the higher self. The same truth may be expressed in a slightly different form, indeed in many forms. Ma, Buddhi and Manas in man reflect in their smaller spheres the characteristics of the great Trinity. Ma is the consciousness of self, and also the will, which gives, page 301, self-direction. Manas, at the other pole, is consciousness of the world, and its thought power does all our work, even that which is effected through the hands. But Buddhi, between the two, is the very essence of consciousness, of subjectivity. Beyond this middle member, triple in character, is the monad in man, representative of him Parabrahman, the state of his true and absolute nirvana, beyond consciousness. The Atma is the state of his false and relative nirvana, of the nirvanic or Atmic plane, his last illusion, that persists between the fourth, Arhat and fifth, adept, initiations. As the monad lies above the trinity of consciousness, so the personal bodies lie outside or beneath it. They are known only in reflection in manas. We may perhaps presume, though here we are going far beyond actual knowledge, that when we have finally and fully realized that the monad is the true man, we shall find, beyond that again, a yet further and more glorious extension. We shall find that the spark has never been separated from the fire, but that, as the ego stands behind the personality, as the monad stands behind the ego, so a planetary angel stands behind the monad, and the solar deity himself stands behind the planetary angel. Perhaps, even further still, it may be that, in some way infinitely higher, and so at present utterly incomprehensible, a greater deity stands behind the solar deity, and behind even that, through many stages, there must rest the supreme over all. But here even thought fails us, and silence is the only true reverence. Page 199. In the average man the monad is, of course, but little in touch with the ego and the lower personality, although both of these are yet somehow expressions of him. Just as it is evolution for the personality to learn to express the ego more fully, so it is evolution for the ego to learn to express the monad more fully. And just as the ego in time learns to control and dominate the personality, so the monad, in his turn, learns to dominate the ego. Page 302. Diagram XLI is a rough illustration of the relation between monad, ego and personality, and the stages by which these three gradually come more and more into touch with one another. At the left-hand side of the diagram, we see the ego represented as very small. He is just a baby ego, complete, but small and undeveloped. The personality is also slender, indicating its primitive condition. As evolution proceeds, the personality gradually widens out, until eventually it becomes equilateral, indicating that it is well developed, all round, symmetrical. Also, it will be observed, the link between the personality and the ego, at first very narrow, has widened out, until it becomes almost as wide as the full width of the personality. Whilst this has been going on, at the same time, the ego has been steadily growing in size, and the channel between him and the monad has also been steadily increasing in width. Thus, at the right-hand side of the diagram, we have a strong and wide channel between the monad and ego, the ego himself being fully developed, exercising, through a wide and well-developed link, full control over a symmetrically developed personality. Finally, the time will come when, just as the personality and ego have become one, the monad and ego also become one. This is the unification of the ego with the monad, and when that is achieved the man has attained, page 303, the object of his descent into matter, he has become the superman, the adept. Page 200, diagrams Li monad, ego and personality, at one moment. This diagram is an attempt to indicate : 1 the complete alignment, or unification of monad, ego and personality, 2 the consequent one center of consciousness, 3 the one life flowing through all three, 4 the limitation imposed upon the manifestations of the one life by the outline barriers of personality, ego and monad. 5 The fact that personality, ego and even monad are but mayavic or illusory veils imposed upon the divine life. 6 The fact that the one life itself is unlimited and universal, as indicated by the circularity of the aura of radiation, thus transcending its expressions through monad, ego and personality. With one portion of myself I manifest, but I remain. Diagrams Li illustrates this consummation. Here we see the monad, ego and personality in perfect alignment, veritably and at one moment the same life permeates all three of its manifestations, but the personality, owing to its size and its constitution, is able to express less of the one life than the ego is able to do, and the ego, in his turn, for similar reasons, is able to express less than can the monad. Even the monad cannot confine, contain, or express the whole of the divine life which radiates out from and beyond that veil, however thin, of separative matter, which makes him a distinct being. When this consummation is reached, then only, for the first time, does the entity enter upon, page 304, his real life, for the whole of this stupendous process of evolution is but a preparation for that true life of the spirit, which begins only when man becomes more than man. Humanity is the final class of the world school, and, when a man passes out of this, he enters the life of the glorified spirit, the life of the Christ. That life has a glory and a splendor beyond all comparison and all comprehension, but the attainment of it by every one of us is an absolute certainty, from which we cannot escape even if we would. If we act, page 201, selfishly, if we set ourselves against the current of evolution, we can delay our progress, but we cannot finally prevent it. There is thus a very close correspondence between the relationship of the monad to the ego, and the ego to the personality. Just as the ego is for long ages the ensouling force of the personality, so there comes a time eventually when the ego himself becomes a vehicle, ensouled by the monad, now fully active and awakened. All the manifold experiences of the ego, all the splendid qualities developed in him, all these pass into the monad himself, and find there a vastly fuller realization than even the ego could have given them. The question arises, does the monad, in the case of the ordinary man, ever do anything which affects, or can affect, his personality down here? Such interference appears to be most unusual. The ego is trying on behalf of the monad, to obtain perfect control of the personality, and to use it as an instrument. But, because that object is not yet fully achieved, the monad may well feel that the time has not yet come for him to intervene from his own level, and to bring the whole of his force to bear, when that which is already in action is more than strong enough for the required purpose. But, when the ego is already beginning to succeed, in his effort to manage his lower vehicles, then the monad does sometimes intervene. In the course of investigating some thousands of human beings, traces of such intervention were found in only a few. The most prominent instance is that, page 305, given in the 29th life of Alcyone, when he pledged himself to the Lord Buddha to devote himself in future lives to the attainment of the Buddhahood in order to help humanity. This being a promise for the far distant future, it was obvious that the personality, through which it was given, could by no means keep it. Investigation revealed that even the ego, though full of enthusiasm at the idea, was being impelled by a mightier force from within which, he could not have resisted, even had he wished to do so. Following the clue still further, it was found that the impelling force came forth unmistakably from the monad. He had decided, and he registered his decision. His will, working through the ego, will clearly have no difficulty in bringing all future personalities into harmony with his great intention. Other examples of the same phenomenon were found. Certain monads had already responded to the call of the higher authorities, and had decided that their representative personalities should assist in the work of the sixth root race in California, some hundreds of years hence. Because of that decision, nothing that these personalities might do during the intervening time could possibly interfere with the carrying out of that decision. The compelling force is thus not from without, but from within, from the real man himself. When the monad has decided, the thing will be done, and it is well for the personality to yield gracefully and readily, recognizing the voice from above, and cooperating gladly. If he does not do this, then he will lay up for himself much useless suffering. It is always the man himself who is doing this thing, and he, in the personality, has to realize that the ego is himself, and he was for the moment to take it for granted that the monad is still more himself, final and greatest expression of him. Page 202. What is known as the Great Company of Servers affords another instance. The servers are a type apart, to which monads seem to be attached ab initio. However, page 306, long it may take for the type to be expressed in the outer consciousness. In a certain sense, it is a kind of predestination, the monad having taken the resolve. For further account of the servers, vide article, entitled The Servers by C.W. Leadbeater, in The Theosophist, September 1913. In view of the general consideration that in a perfectly ordered universe there is no room for chance, it seems probable that the very mode of individualization, from the animal kingdom, was somehow predetermined, either for or by the monad himself, with a view to preparation for whatever portion of the great work he is to undertake in the future. For there will come a time when we shall all be part of the great heavenly man, not in the least as a myth or a poetic symbol, but as a vivid and actual fact, which certain investigators have themselves seen. That celestial body has many members. Each of these members has its own function to fulfill, and the living cells which are to form part of them need widely different experiences to prepare them. It may well be that, from the dawn of evolution, the parts have been chosen, but each monad has his destined line of evolution, and his freedom of action is concerned chiefly with the rate at which he shall move along that line. In the celebration of the Holy Eucharist, there is a good deal of symbolism concerned with the monad, the ego and the personality. Briefly speaking first of the three persons of the Trinity, the host typifies God the Father, and also stands for the Deity, whole and indivisible. The wine stands for God the Son, whose life is poured down into the chalice of material form. The water represents God the Holy Ghost, the Spirit who brooded over the face of the waters, and yet at the same time is himself symbolized by water. Speaking next of the Deity in man, the host signifies the monad, the totality, the unseen cause of all. The paten means the tripled male spirit through which the monad acts on matter. The wine indicates page 307, the individuality, poured into the chalice of the causal body. The water represents the personality which is so intimately mixed with it. Passing to the effect of communion upon the communicant, the force of the host is essentially monadic, and acts most powerfully upon whatever within the man represents the direct action of the monad. The force of the chalice is more that of the ego. The wine has a very powerful force upon the higher astral levels, and the water sends out even etheric vibrations. When the priest makes the three crosses with the host over the chalice, he wills strongly that the influence from the monadic levels descend into the ego in its threefold manifestation of ma, buddhi and manas, and then, as he makes the two crosses between, page 203, the chalice and his own breast, he draws that influence into his own mental and astral bodies, that through him it may radiate fully upon his people. This symbolizes the earlier stages of evolution, when the monad hovers over his lower manifestations, brooding, page 308 over them, acting upon them, but never touching them. So the priest holds the host above the chalice, yet never touches the one with the other until the appointed time has come. When the priest drops the fragment of the host into the chalice, he thereby signifies the descent of a ray of the monad into the ego. To facilitate memorization of this system of symbols, diagrams Li is appended. Page 204, Chapter 34, The Second and Higher Initiations, page 309, each stage of the path proper is divided into four steps, dash, the first is its mago, or way, during which the student is striving to cast off the fetters. The second is its phala, literally fruit or result, when the man finds the result of his efforts showing themselves more and more. The third is its bhavaga, or consummation, the period when, the result having culminated, he is able to fulfill satisfactorily the work belonging to the step on which he now firmly stands. The fourth is its gotrabhu, which means the time when he has arrived at a fit state to receive the next initiation. This means complete and entire freedom from the fetters of his stage on the path. The first of the three fetters, or samayojana, which have to be cast off before the candidate can take the second initiation, is sakkayadithi, the delusion of self. This is the I am, I consciousness which, as connected with the personality, is nothing but an illusion, and must be got rid of at the very first step of the real upward path. But to cast off the fetter completely means even more than this, for it involves the realization of the fact that the individuality also is, in very truth, one with the all, that it can therefore never have any interests opposed to those of its brethren, and that it is most truly progressing when it most assists the progress of others. The second fetter is vicikicca, doubt or uncertainty. The candidate must arrive at the certainty of conviction, founded on individual experiment, or mathematical reasoning. He believes, not, page 310 because he has been told, but because facts are now self-evident. This is the only method of resolving doubt known to occultism. The third fetter is silabat paramisa, or superstition. This includes all kinds of unreasoning and mistaken belief, and all dependence upon outward rites and ceremonies to purify the heart. The man must realize that within himself deliverance must be sought, and that, however valuable aids such as ceremonies, etc., may be in developing will, wisdom and love, yet they can never take the place of that personal effort by which alone he can achieve. The knowledge of the spiritual permanence of the true ego brings reliance on one's own spiritual strength, and so dispels superstition. The Buddhic consciousness is directly related to these three fetters, for they are all dispelled by that consciousness. Recognizing the unity, the man can have no delusion of separateness. Seeing for himself the great laws of life in operation, he can no longer doubt. He sees all the roads that lead to the one bliss, and that all roads are good, so that he can no longer hold to the superstition that any one form of, page 205, belief is necessary, to one who has attained that level. The second initiation takes place in the lower mental world, so that the candidate must have developed the power to function freely in his mental body. This initiation rapidly continues the development of the mental body, and at or near this point the pupil learns to use the Mayavirupa, Vidhi the mental body, p. 169. At the second initiation, the key of knowledge is given. The initiator pouring out, from his own mental and causal bodies, rays of power which, falling on the mental and causal bodies of the initiate, stimulate into sudden and splendid growth. The germs of similar powers therein existing, as though a bud, stimulated by the sun rays, should suddenly burst into all the glory of the opened flower, so do the mental and causal bodies suddenly unfold the powers latent within them, page 311, expanding into radiant beauty. Through them, now expanded, body or intuition can play freely, the great new power being thus set free to work. The period after the second initiation is in many ways the most dangerous anywhere on the path. It is at this stage that, if there is any weakness in a candidate's character, it will find him out. In nearly all cases, the danger comes through pride. It is indicated in the gospel story by the temptation in the wilderness. As the first initiation corresponds to a new birth, so may the second initiation be compared to the baptism of the Holy Ghost and fire, for it is the power of the third person of the Trinity that is outpoured at that moment, in what may but inadequately be described as a flood of fire. The man at this stage is known to the Buddhists as a Sakadagamin, the man who returns but once, the meaning being that he should need but one more incarnation before attaining arhatship, the fourth initiation. The Hindu name for this step is the Kittachaka, the man who builds a hut, he who builds a hut, he who has reached a place of peace. At this stage no additional fetters are cast off, but it is usually a period of considerable psychic and intellectual advancement. The man must have the astral consciousness at his command during physical waking life, and, during sleep, the heaven world will be open before him. When the third initiation is passed, the man becomes the Anagamin, which means literally, he who does not return, for it is expected of him that he will attain the next initiation in the same incarnation. The Hindu name for this stage is the Hamsa, which means a swan, but the word is also considered to be a form of the sentence Soham, that am I. There is a tradition, too, that the swan is able to separate milk from water, and the sage is similarly able to realize the true value, for living beings, of the phenomenon of life. Page 206. This initiation is typified, in the Christian symbolism, page 312. By the transfiguration of the Christ. He went up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before his disciples, his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light, exceeding white as snow, so as no fuller on earth can white them. This description suggests the Augeides, the glorified man, and it is an accurate picture of what happens at this initiation, for, just as the second initiation is principally concerned with the quickening of the lower mental body, so at this stage the causal body is especially developed. The ego is brought more closely into touch with the monad, and is thus transfigured in very truth. Even the personality is affected by that wondrous outpouring. The higher and the lower self became one at the first initiation, and that unity is never lost, but the development of the higher self, that now takes place, can never be measured in the lower worlds of form, although the two are one to the greatest possible extent. At this stage, the man is brought before the spiritual king of the world, the head of the occult hierarchy, who, at this step, either confers the initiation himself, or deputes one of his pupils, the three lords of the flame, to do so. In the latter event, the man is presented to the king soon after the initiation has taken place. Thus the Christ is brought into the presence of his Father, the body in the initiate is raised, until it becomes one with its origin on the nirvanic plane, and a very wonderful union between the first and second principles in man is thus effected. The Anagamin enjoys, while moving through the round of his daily work, all the splendid possibilities given by full possession of the faculties of the higher mental plane, and during the sleep of the body, he enters the buddhic plane. In this stage, he has to throw off any lingering remains of the fourth and fifth fetters attachment to the enjoyment of sensation, typified by earthly love, and all possibility of anger or hatred. He must become free from the possibility of being enslaved in, page 313, any way by external things. He must rise above all considerations connected with the mere personality of those around him, recognizing that the affection which flourishes upon the path is an affection between egos. Therefore it is strong and permanent, without fear of diminution or fluctuation, for it is that perfect love which casteth out fear. The fourth initiation is known as that of the Arhat, which means the worthy, the capable, the venerable or perfect. The Hindus call the Arhat the Paramahamsa, the one above and beyond the Hamsa.